Right, let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 33. What we have just been quoting has been the verses 28 and 29 of Deuteronomy 33, which happen in fact to be the last verses of the chapter. So having proved from the last verses of the chapter and from the blessings here that all of these blessings are future, obviously then the whole tenor of the chapter must be future. Well, it's... Oh, well, I haven't quoted all the verses, no. No, okay. Arnold's picked us up on the point that verses 28 and 29 don't cover all of those blessings.
No, these... verse 28 is really verse 8.
Yes, but you see, he's going on to talk about them dwelling safely further down, which is taken from verse 28. He's only quoted verses 28 and 29, but in fact what he's doing is he's quoting in context the whole of the chapter, and he's taking us right back now to verses 1 and 2. So that statement there, Israel then shall dwell in safety alone, from verse 28, is what he's talking about down here in the latter part. What you're saying is Brother Thomas should have noted all of the verses he's quoting. So, well, he didn't. But, well, he's really telling us we've got to read the whole chapter anyway. All right.
You haven't sort of discovered a formula he may have used which defines which ones he was quoting.
Actually, he quotes just so many that I think we're very fortunate that he bothers to tell us, you know, as many as he does. If he kept putting in the actual quotation of everything, he would break the flow up just so much. So I can only suggest that he... he quotes it in the next page. I haven't got a real concrete answer to that, and I think perhaps everyone can come to their own. What words changed in the one in Habakkuk or what? Revive his work in the midst of the years. Perhaps while we're handling these questions, you might like to turn over the tapes at this stage. I think I'd better, after that little bit of a diversion, just reiterate what I was saying. He quoted from Deuteronomy chapter 33, verses 28, 29, and other verses, to show to us that the blessings that Moses gave upon the children of Israel were obviously to be future. Now, if that's the case, we can take it that that chapter is speaking in a future sense. Consequently, when we go back now to Deuteronomy chapter 33 and the opening verses, we read there in verse 1, "And this is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And he said," now this is where it starts, "Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of saints. From his right hand went a fiery law for them," and so forth and so on, and then he goes into the blessings on the sons. Now, the doctor says, if these blessings are all future, obviously this whole song is prophetic of a future work. And therefore the coming from Sinai, and the rising up from Mount Seir, and the shining forth from Mount Paran, are all part and parcel of this future manifestation. And so he puts it forward then as the first part of the answer to the question, where is he to come to? Well, let's go back and let the doctor explain this for us in his own words. The bottom paragraph on page 545. Now he says, in the preface to this prophetic blessing, it is written that Moses said, and these are the words we've just read, Yahweh came from Sinai, and you might as well underline from, because in a moment he's going to put the word to in italics. Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of saints. It was historically true that Yahweh came to Sinai. See, he's got two in inverted commas. Not in inverted commas, in italics I mean. But there is nothing more in this than an historical allusion. Without other light than this affords, we could hardly answer the question with full satisfaction. We know that Israel's history is typical, and that the text is in connection with prophecy. Still, came is so decidedly past time that it causes one to pause before we affirm that it here predicts the future. So he's trying to be very fair about it. He's saying the blessings which Moses gave upon Israel are obviously prophetic of the future. Therefore, the opening verses of the chapter must also be future. But, he says, you may care to argue that it's in the past tense that Yahweh came from Sinai. So he says, well, in answer to that, he said, I would say that I know of no occasion when Yahweh came from Sinai, historically. He came to Sinai, but we don't know of any instance where he came from Sinai. Nevertheless, he says, you may still argue that it's past tense. All right, well, if this was the only chapter, maybe we're not on a strong foundation. So he allows the critic to reserve the right to say, well, I don't like the past tense there. I don't like you making past tense future. So he says, let's have a look at a few other passages which will confirm the fact that although it is stated in the past tense, this is quite a frequent method of writing in the prophets, that whilst it is past tense, it is speaking of a future event as though it had already been accomplished. So he says, let's have a look at another passage. This is now the second of these three passages, and it's Psalm 68. Psalm 68. The Spirit enlarges, he says, our conception somewhat on this point in Psalm LXVII. That's 50 plus 10 plus 5 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. That's 68, verses 17 and 18. Here it seems to indicate a future manifestation in the wilderness of Sinai and Paran. Now, we're going to have a look at this particular area. Just for the moment, let's put up a transparency which gives us some idea of the terms that are being used. Here is the general wilderness of Sinai, and here is the wilderness of Paran a little further to the north. So those are two of the terms that we are coming across, and we'll look at these in a little more detail when we get on to page 547. So he says, here it seems to indicate a future manifestation in the wilderness of Sinai and the wilderness of Paran. And he's quoting from Psalm 68. Let's have a look at it. Psalm 68. Are the verses right this time, Arnold? Yes, they are, aren't they? 17 and 18? Only just. The chariots of Elohim are 20,000. I'll read it as it is in the AV. Even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them as in Sinai in the holy place. Thou hast ascended on high. Thou hast led captivity captive. Thou hast received gifts for men. Yea, for the rebellious also, that Yahweh Elohim might dwell among them. Brother Thomas says, the chariots of Elohim are 20,000, thousands repeated. The Lord Adonai among them, Sinai in the holy. There is a suggestion on the part of some authorities that that word Lord there is in fact Yahweh. We won't get involved in an argument on that at the moment, but the Soferim put that down as one of the, what is it, 134 or 7, is it? 134 places where the word Lord in little letters should have actually been Yahweh. And in my Bible, I've got it coloured in green, meaning it should be Yahweh. Brother Thomas obviously didn't have access to that particular authority, and he leaves it there as Adonai. So we just make that comment in passing. Nevertheless, it doesn't alter the general context or sense of what we are talking about. He says, the chariots of Elohim are 20,000, thousands repeated, the Lord among them, Sinai in the holy. Now that's a bit different. The Lord among them, Sinai in the holy. Well, let him explain what he means. Then follows in the 18th verse the prophecy of Christ's ascension, as Paul interprets it. Paul interprets it? Where does Paul interpret that? Ephesians 4 verse 8. Good. Yes, we picked that up from the margin. In Ephesians 4 verse 8, Paul quotes that, and he tells us this applied to the Lord Jesus Christ. Nothing wrong, you're not cheating by using the margin. Quite at liberty to do that. After which, in verse 22, the Lord saith, I will bring again from the depths of the sea. The English version interjects, is among them as in Sinai in the holy place. But, and he quotes the Hebrew, Sinai Bakadesh is equivalent to in Sinai the holy. This conclusion is strengthened by verse 22. For how can the Lord bring again from the depths of the sea unless he gather his people in the vicinity of the Red Sea? Well, I could at this time digress onto an exposition of Psalm 68, but I don't want to do it. I think we'll just leave the comment as it stands, that what Brother Thomas is basically trying to do now is to confirm the fact that what Deuteronomy 33 says is endorsed here by Psalm 68, that it's speaking of a future manifestation of deity in the area of Sinai. And again, he will come back and make passing reference to this again later. So I want to keep moving then on to this third reference now, which is in the next paragraph, which is Habakkuk 3. So it's Deuteronomy 33, Psalm 68, and now Habakkuk chapter 3, which all refer to a manifestation in the area of Sinai and Paran. He says, but Habakkuk has made certain what, without his testimony, might be thought open to dispute. In the third chapter of his book, he prays that Yahweh would revive his work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make known or manifest, and in wrath, remember mercy. Well, we know where that one comes from, don't we? Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 2. And hereafter, every time you read that verse, there will be a shiver of conscience, because you'll think that was the one I didn't know that I should have known. So, over to Habakkuk chapter 3, because he's going to make some references to this now. Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 2. He says, now in response to this, he is favoured with a vision, in describing which he says, Eloah, the singular, not Elohim, came from Teman. Teman means the south. So he came from the south. See, this area is south of Jerusalem. Here it is, Sinai, Paran, the general term applying to the south. He came in from Teman, he came in from the south. And the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. If this testimony had been faithfully translated, there would have been no obscurity in it. So here's some Bible marking to be done when you go home, to put in the more correct translation against Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 3. The word... I missed a bit. The prophet did not write, Eloah came from Teman. That's what it says in the Authorized Version. The word rendered came is not bar, as in Deuteronomy 33 verse 2, where it is correctly translated. See, this is his argument. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 33, it says Yahweh came. And he says, well, you might say came is past tense. All right, he says, you say came is past tense, Fair enough, it's past tense. But I think it's got a future application, and I'll prove it to you. Turn to Habakkuk chapter 3. Because in Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 3 it says, Eloah came from Teman. But here it's not came. It's not the same word. It's not the word bar, as back in Deuteronomy chapter 33. But it is the word yavo, the future of the same verb, and therefore to be rendered shall come in. Notice that in italics it's important. So the text should thus be rendered, Eloah shall come in from the south, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. Selah. Eloah is the word used for the setter up of the kingdom in Daniel chapter 2 verse 44. It signifies the adorable one or the strong one. It is the deity made flesh and justified by spirit and equivalent to the Holy One or the Messiah. So, Deuteronomy 33, Psalm 68, and it's all clinched by Habakkuk chapter 3, where that word came is in the future tense, saying there is yet to be a future manifestation when Yahweh, manifesting himself in this spirit rainbowed angel, shall come in from Teman, from Paran, from Sinai, from that area. And so the Eloah, he says, is the one who will be the setter up of the kingdom. Daniel 2 verse 44, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Felt sure someone was going to contradict the doctor there and say that the word in Daniel 2:44 isn't Eloah. You thought we'd understand it. I'd understand it, did you? Yes. Well, to put your mind at rest, it's not Eloah, but it's the Chaldean equivalent of it. From Daniel chapter 1, verse 7, through to the end of Daniel chapter 7, the language of the book changes from Hebrew to Syriac or Aramaic or Chaldean. And then from chapter 8 onwards, it changes back to Hebrew. It tells you where it changes. It says, then the king spake unto them in Syriac, doesn't it? What's that, verse 4, is it? Daniel chapter 1, verse 4. So from there on, the language is not Hebrew, but it's a language which is very close to Hebrew. So that in fact the word God in Daniel 2, verse 44 is not in Hebrew, it's in Aramaic, and it's the word Elah, but it's the equivalent of Eloah. So don't really worry, but I just thought there might have been someone who was a little bit technical, not looking at anybody in particular, but I thought they might have picked it up. So that's the point. Well, there are three very convincing quotations, aren't they? I conclude then, says Brother Thomas, from this positive declaration of Habakkuk, that Moses spake not historically, but prophetically. The coming of Yahweh to Sinai in the days of Moses was representative as to power, place, and purpose of his coming in the latter day. Since Habakkuk wrote the words, Eloah shall come in from the south, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, the prediction has not been fulfilled in any sense. I didn't really read that sentence well. I should have said, since Habakkuk wrote those words. In other words, at no time between the days when Habakkuk wrote and the time of Brother Thomas's writing, or even at the day for that matter, could it be said that this has ever been fulfilled. If it had, his glory would now cover the heavens, and the earth be filled with his praise, which is very far from being the fact. And that, of course, is the latter part of Habakkuk 3, verse 3. This, then, I believe, is the place or the country to which the personal Son of Man, the man Christ Jesus, will come first at his approaching advent. The region is admirably adapted for the manifestation of omnipotence in the judicial, that is, in the sense of judgment, in the judicial manifestation of the mystical Son of Man or the rainbowed angel. The peninsula of Sinai is the southern region which is reserved in solitude for a future display of great signs and wonders far transcending anything witnessed by Israel in the olden time. This peninsula is formed by two arms running into the land from the north end of the Red Sea and is bounded by the one styled the Tongue of the Egyptian Sea, on the southwest, at the end of which is Suez, and by the other, or Elanitic Gulf, called also the Gulf of Aqaba on the east, which in simple language is simply telling us that it's that area there with Suez up here and Aqaba there and your two gulfs there. So it is this triangular section of land in there. Nothing more complicated than that at this stage. These waters form two divergent sides of a triangle, within the area of which are Mount Sinai and Paran and a waste howling wilderness containing nothing to be desired. Moses styles it a great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water. It is a dry, hot, sandy, mountainous region that no government seeks to annex and which no emigrants undertake to people. Well, that's not strictly true today, is it? Because at least Israel has annexed it, but we can understand what he means, that certainly it's not the area that people would naturally go and desire to inhabit and set up the sort of towns that we've got here. The few that are found within it are the descendants of Hagar, the Ishmaelites, wild men whose hand is against every man and every man's hand against them. From Suez to Aqaba, at the northern extremity of the Gulf of Aqaba, a road was constructed by the Romans, measuring 125 miles in a straight line. The peninsula included within these limits is filled up with mountains and narrow valleys and desolate plains. Of these mountains, the chief or elevated circle of Sinai, of these mountains, the chain or elevated circle of Sinai is the chief. Now, in that paragraph, all he's told us is that you've got a triangle here, sort of an inverted triangle, the Gulf of Aqaba, the Suez through here, and Sinai and Paran generally in that area. But those of you who've read this through will realise that the next couple of paragraphs get fairly detailed. And rather than just skip over them, I thought we would try to illustrate just what he is saying here by some other maps. But to show these other maps, I'm going to need to use the projector, and that means we'll need to have the lights off. So if we can have the lights off, and I'll project up here another map, we'll follow through. Maybe if we can leave just enough lights on for people to see. What if that's possible? Where are we? Yes, perhaps if you could just leave the other lot of lights on. That lot. Yeah. We'll see how we go anyway, like that. Because you want to read what it says in your reader. Oh, no. Perhaps just the back hall light. Could we try just the back light? Oh, you know, the ones out there. Harold, can you hear me? He's gone to sleep in the dark. Harold, could you turn on the lights in the back hall so we might be able to just see a little bit of light? Oh, yes, I think I can read it from that. Good. Now, the next paragraph says, to the northward of the central region of Sinai and divided from it by a broad valley called El Sheikh is a mountain range extending eastward called Zebir. Right. Now, this is what we've got to work out. For those who can't see this, if you can get access to Stanley's Sinai and Palestine, you will find that I am referring to a chart which is actually taken from there. Now, this particular valley that he is talking about is this wadi which goes through here. Sinai itself is this area just in here. Santa Catrina's monastery is just there. And so you've got this wadi which he styles El Sheikh, or which is called on this map Wadi Esh Sheikh, but it's the same one, runs up through there, and he says joins into the a range of mountains extending eastward called Zebir. I can't find it named on this map or any other name or any other map, but I presume it's this range along here. So this is the general area of Sinai,
That's the general area of Sinai, and this is the wadi which comes up here and joins into this mountain range. Just for a moment, we'll go on to the next slide, and then we'll come back to that one. This is an enlarged view of that particular area. Here is the Sinai peak here, and here is the wadi that he's talking about. We'll show you some photos in a moment, because anybody coming into here now has to come up this particular wadi, along which you get some excellent views of Sinai. So you see, Brother Thomas is saying, to the northward and central region of Sinai, and divided from it by a broad valley, that's this valley here, called L-shape, there is a range, go back, that's right, there is this range extending eastward across here. So he's getting quite detailed in his description. North of this are sandy plains and valleys. Here it is, see the brown colour, sandy plains and valleys, the most barren and destitute of water of the whole country. This section borders still further north on another mountain chain termed LT. And there it is there. Gibor LT. So this is your other mountain range, but not quite as high as this one here, and composed of different materials. There we are. The red you see is granite. This is granite. The brownie colours are gravel or sand. What's that one? That's grey. Well, that's limestone. So you see, these are granite. There's quite a distinct change. You'll see it in some photos in a moment. This is all the granite area of Sinai. Now, separating this granite area from this northern area is this sandy plain. And then you get another range of hills up here which are no longer granite ones, but which are in fact the limestone ones. And that's what he is saying. So that this section borders still further north on another mountain chain termed LT, this one across here, which stretches nearly across the peninsula from gulf to gulf. See? It gets nearly right across from one gulf to the other. Still north of this range is the desert of LT. There it is, of LT, and the word desert, I'm afraid, just didn't get onto the slide. But that's the desert of that there. I can show you the original of this chart if you'd like to see the whole lot of it. I've got it here. So, we've got the granite mountains of Sinai. We've got that wadi that goes up there and leads into this plain. And now we've got further north of there a range of limestone hills merging into this desert. Fortunately, you see, Brother Thomas was writing 100 years ago, and this book of Stanley's is about that old too. So consequently, the names are similar. It's very difficult to get the names that Brother Thomas uses on modern maps, because many of them have been changed, both into English and in some cases into Hebrew as well. He says, still north of this range is the desert of LT, through which ran the old Roman road, and at present the great pilgrim road from Egypt by Suez to Aqaba on the way to Mecca. North and northwest, and indeed inclusive of the desert of LT, is the wilderness of Paran. That's further up there, more in that part there. You saw it on the original transparency over there. So you see, here is Sinai, the granite peak. Then you've got the range of limestone mountains merging into the desert, and the top section of it, or the northern, northwest, northern section of it, is the wilderness of Paran. The wilderness lies between the southern border of Palestine and the Mediterranean on the north, Egypt on the west, Idumea or Edom on the east, and the LT range of the peninsula on the south. I don't know what happened then or how we got that, but... we went backwards, that's right. Okay, well, let's just quickly go on forwards and pick up some of these details. Let's just have a look at this wadi, which of course is the main point of our consideration. This is where it's all going to start. It's got to start from Sinai and work up. So that's what we will do. We'll start from Sinai and we'll work up. This particular photo would be taken from somewhere around about here, looking across to the main peak of Sinai, which is in here. You're sort of looking across these hills in the foreground as you're coming up this particular wadi. And you can see the peak of Sinai behind there. Similar view taken with a telephoto lens. Coming closer up to some of these hills, you can see the nature of the rocks there. Again, in that wadi. As you come up to the top of the wadi, you can see the monastery here at the foot of the mountain of Sinai itself. You can see the stark nature of the granite rocks which are there. A close-up view of the monastery, St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of Sinai, and looking up from the monastery, you can see the awe-inspiring peaks of the hills above. And a similar view again, looking up there. Well, coming down then in the other direction, going back along that wadi, you can see how it's quite wide. I think Brother Thomas says in Eureka it's not more than 200 yards wide at any stage. Well, you come out here, and on the way you can pass sites like that, which bears out what the doctor was saying about the descendants of Hagar being there. And about 13 kilometres from the peak, they have now built an airfield. So here is an airfield, which of course plans to land at. And from here, one can drive up that wadi into the vicinity of Sinai itself. Moving further northward, a view from the air coming up now more over that LT range, coming away from Sinai, which would be here, and looking up more to the broken area up here, one comes up the Gulf of Aqaba, or coming out over the sea itself, looking back. Now this is still the granite part here. The other one is a little bit up further up here. This would still be the granite area. But you can see how inspiring these peaks are. Now coming up further now, up into the area of Edom, the nature of it has changed, and whilst you mightn't be able to see from where you are, that it looks very much different from the air, in fact there is quite some difference. So that just gives us one or two pictures of what this area is like, moving progressively from the southern area up to the northern area. So we can have our lights back on now, and we haven't got much time left, so we'll just wind up this particular paragraph. Alright, well I've tried to then make that a little bit more meaningful, because just reading through some of these names here which look pretty Arabic to me, and possibly very few of you were able to get atlases which made much sense on that. I hope you can see then what he is talking about here from that particular map. And if you want to follow out that map again, I can give you access to the originals of those two maps, which I'll leave out the front here, which are very interesting to study. We took them with us when we were down in that area, and we found it particularly valuable to have it always with us and to follow the different places we were going to. So for those who of course can't see the slides on the tape, we apologise, but anyhow, we hope that they can do the best with Eureka without the slides. So the part where we left off was at the bottom of page 547. The wilderness lies between the southern border of Palestine, I read that, and over the page, and the no, we got to the bottom of the page, and the LT range of the peninsula on the south. The Holy One, says Habakkuk, writing in Jerusalem, will come in from Mount Paran.
He says the Holy One will come in from Mount Paran.
That's the clearest thing to do at this stage, is simply to put back that transparency and see where we are now. There's your range of granite hills there. Then there's the gap, the range of limestone hills, then merging into the wilderness of Paran, or as it was called, the wilderness of LT. And it's from this area, from Sinai through Paran, up into Edom and into the land, that the prophet is going to now present this picture.
By the help of Moses, we understand that he arrived at Paran from Sinai. Ah, remember the point that was made a few pages earlier? You'd almost forgotten it, hadn't you? On the bottom of page 545, you had to underline the word from Sinai in that last paragraph. Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. The doctor says it was historically true that Yahweh came to Sinai, but there is nothing more in this than an historical allusion. Now you see, he points out, that with the help of Moses, from Deuteronomy 33, in conjunction with Habakkuk 3, we can now see that that he arrived at Paran from Sinai, which Habakkuk simply styles as Teman, or the south. Habakkuk had a vision of what was to be transacted in the country of the south, which will be left in the rear by an advance from Mount Paran after bringing affliction there on the tents of Cushan and causing the curtains of the land of Midian to tremble. Now this is from Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 7, and I would think that at this stage we won't attempt to go into that in detail, because Brother Thomas will himself deal with it in more detail. But the verse says, as he quotes it, I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. So he's depicting now this march from Sinai up into the land. Well, I think that's a logical place to leave it, because he's now going on to speak about Moses' position when he placed the blessing, pronounced the blessing upon the people. So really, what we've seen tonight is Brother Thomas's explanation of how he believes the Lord will first appear in the area of Sinai, and how he will march up through the area of Paran, and then ultimately up into the Promised Land. Well, all that's very interesting, but if we can't somehow or other relate it back to ourselves in an exhortational sense, well then it doesn't become anything more than interesting. For me, what I think is the most powerful fact is the way that Brother Thomas hasn't so much here given us a topographical or a geographical description of these movements, but rather that he has emphasized the fact that the one who is to be the nucleus of all this is one who was justified by the Spirit, who was made Spirit, who was made strong and sits at the right hand of Deity, and when he returns, he is to be the nucleus of this Spirit rainbowed unity. And so all of this knowledge about where Sinai is, where Paran is, and all of these things are interesting and important, but they are only a means to an end. We don't want to go away tonight excited that we've learned a little bit about the topography of Sinai, but the fact that it shows to us that what is going to happen in the future is to be real and tangible, but it is dependent now as to what sort of preparation we are making in studying books like this. We must study them from the right angle, with a desire to stimulate our thinking, to elevate our thinking, and above all to make it spiritual thinking, that we might be part of this Spirit rainbow unity which Brother Thomas talks about in this section. Well, homework for next class is obvious, isn't it? We not only read this section again, but we also look for all of the little things in inverted commas, and maybe even some that aren't in inverted commas that are also quotations. And look, you'll get much more enjoyment out of it if you find them, rather than having me tell you it. So we leave it off there at page 548, take it up from there next time, and see how far we can get at the next class.
Bring this class to a conclusion, brethren, just as with prayer, after first singing hymn 140. Hymn 140.